Okay, so as I said, this is going to be after a great delay because of some things we had to deal with, which I think we've finally accomplished. This is part two of the Apostle Paul and Kingdom Reconstruction. We talked back when, of course, the date today is November 15th of 08, and when we talked about this before, it was probably at least a couple months ago. I'm not sure. Maybe a month or 6 weeks. I'm not sure, but it was a while back. But we were discussing how Paul and his peers and the church of what we call the New Testament church were actually not only advocating, but were putting into place our Lord's kingdom society, his law order, a society within a society, that they were putting in place a kingdom law order that operated separate from statist tyrannical society, which they were living and suffering under, the tyrannical statist society. And so we looked at several things back then, several passages, but I want to start today with Isaiah chapter 9, and this will probably become kind of like our theme passage. Starting in verse 6, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be an end to his government in a short order." His government will last a pretty good while. No. "There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forever. The zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this." Now, I want to go back to what we discussed last time. We mentioned in verse 6, the government will rest on his shoulders. Does anybody remember what we said his shoulders are? The ecclesia is his body. And ecclesia is kingdom government. It is kingdom society, which contains government. And the shoulders, we said, were his elders, the elders of the ecclesia. And there will be no end of this government. You know, if we believe that you die to go to heaven, then we think really that his kingdom is off somewhere else and you have to die to get there, which is not the good news of the kingdom. So there are some things we need to understand about what Paul and his peers and the people that we call members of the New Testament church, what they were doing and what was going on in their day. We have not understood, by and large, in what's called Christianity today, what they were doing. What in the world was going on back then? What set them at odds with the Caesar, for instance? What caused the conflict? Why were they being persecuted? Why were they losing their homes and lands? It wasn't because they were being taught by their elders, look, just be subject to the government. Obey the government. Hand over to the government any amount of taxation they ask for. Obviously, they weren't being taught those things like the church is today. So there's something that we miss somewhere. Well, I was at a gathering not too long ago, and a brother had laid some of his articles that he had written on a table toward the back, and I got to looking through some of the articles there to see if there was anything there I'd like to read, and there was. But one particularly jumped out at me. I was just scanning the titles there. One of them was entitled, "Words Mean Things." Words Mean Things. And that title jumped out at me, and so I had to get, that was one of them I had to get. And it was a good article. Words Mean Things. Well, part of the reason that we have missed what was going on in the New Testament is because of a word which we haven't known that it's in there because of the translation, for starters, And then when we discover that it's in there, we don't know what it means. And it's very, very important. It's like understanding, who the Greeks and who the Gentiles are. It's like trying to understand who was grafted in, who was cut out, who was, you know, who are the Gentiles? What is the diaspora? And so forth. Once you understand those words, you begin to understand some things. Well, there's a word that we need to understand. It's the Greek word ekklesia. Let me read to you. I've got several things here, and be patient with me because I'm just going to read for a while from about three different articles. And this is important stuff, so pay attention. The title of this article is The Mistranslation of the Greek Word Ekklesia in the English Bible and Its Ramifications. All right, now I'm just going to start reading here for a minute. I'm going to read, and then I'll go to something else. I'll tell you when I'm reading and when I'm not. And I read at the very beginning. The purpose of this paper is to show that the early translators of the English Bible mistranslated the word ekklesia using the English word church instead of assembly or congregation. This mistranslation has helped promote the false doctrine of a universal church and a hierarchical authority over the local congregation. Showing how this mistranslation has adversely affected the proper understanding of the biblical doctrine of the church will demonstrate the absolute necessity of translating the text literally and rejecting the influence of any particular church's theology. Please note that the use of the word church, church in quotations, does not mean that the Bible has an error. It is common knowledge that the Greek word from which it was translated is ekklesia. Further, the word church is used in modern English to denote a local congregation or assembly as well as buildings and denominations. The problem, as this article points out, is that the word ekklesia would have been better translated assembly or congregation. And in doing so, the false teaching of a universal or invisible church would have been avoided. The reason for the article is to uphold the original meaning and use of the word as God intended. The English word church has various meanings. Webster gives the following definitions for the word church. 1. A building for public Christian worship. 2. A religious service in such a building. 3. The world body of Christian believers, Christendom. Any major division of this body, a Christian denomination. 4. A Christian congregation. 5. Organized religion as distinguished from the state. The Christian before the Reformation. The Roman Catholic Church. The profession of an ecclesiastic to perform a church service of thanksgiving, etc., etc. Okay, so what he's pointing out is what church means today. When we say the English word church, you can say, did you go to church today? Does he go to church? I mean, isn't this true? The English word church means a lot of different things. What church do you go to? What denomination, in other words? What kind of denomination? Or which building do you go to? Did you have a church meeting today? So the English word church kind of leaves us really without much to go on. Whereas, what's that? It's vague. It's vague and it has numerous meanings and it's almost arbitrary. You can use it arbitrarily, you know, whether you're talking about a building or a meeting. Or a group of people. Well, they're that church over there. We can say they're that church over there, you know. But the word ekklesia had a very strong meaning. Now, what this guy is saying in this article is that it makes a difference. Well, first, he's saying that there's been a mistranslation problem. So the first thing we have to settle regarding this is it true? Has there been a mistranslation problem? And then we have to say, does it matter? And in what I'm sharing right now, that is the Apostle Paul, and I could say the Apostle Paul and his contemporaries and Kingdom Reconstruction, this word has everything to do with what we're discussing, and that's why I'm on this, in case you're wondering. That's why I'm going to get on this word, because it matters, because words mean things. And it has everything to do with what was going on here, and once you understand the word, you see it in the scriptures in a different way. Just like some of these other words I just mentioned, how you see things in a different way once you understand what those words... I didn't know what the diaspora was. At some point, what does dispersion mean? What was that, the dispersion? Who was involved in it? Where did they go to? Where did they wind up? So, ecclesia is another one of those words that we've lost. So, dealing with the number one question I said we had to answer, has there been a translation problem? Is there a translation problem? Well, let me just read to you from another article. I've been doing a little research on, again, which I've done before, on the evolution of the King James translation, 1611 King James. Let me just give you a little background. When King James came to the throne, he was the head of a divided church, very much divided. One of those groups we all have come to know as the Puritans. And... King James was a guy who believed in the divine right of kings. And if y'all remember, we've talked about the divine right of kings quite a bit. And King James believed that it was his hereditary right to be head of the church, and that he was the literal physical representation of God on planet Earth as this king. It was his hereditary right to be so. And of course, we would disagree with that. But that was his mindset. His mindset was that the Church of England was the church, the head of the universal church. You know what Catholic means, don't you? Universal. Catholic means universal. And there he was as the head of the universal church, the Church of England. Now, I wanted to briefly touch on one of the rules here, maybe a couple. When he sat these guys down, and of course this went through a process, and I'm not going to spend the time to go into the whole process of years, but before these men began the work of coming up with the King James Version, he gave them some instructions. Here's instruction number one. And I've read, by the way, in my reading on this subject, I've seen that it's reported everywhere from 14 to 16 instructions. But this particular letter here says there were 15, and it's got the 15 instructions in here. Number one, here's instruction number one. The ordinary Bible read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the original will permit. All right? What religion were these men? You'd have to say these men were Catholic. The Bishop's Bible was a Catholic book. It was a Catholic Bible. And they were going to stick with that as best they could. And they did compare other translations, such as the Geneva, for instance. But... And these were scholarly men, by the way. You can't question their scholarly credentials. But what you can see is that they were influenced, number one, by the religion they already had, which was what we would call Catholicism. The Church of England was Catholicism. And their Catholic Bible, the Bishop's Bible, was an influence on them. There was another source of influence, though, on them. You'd never guess what it would be, but it was the influence on their careers and on their pocketbook. Because once they were finished with this work, quite a few of these men who had gained, of course, the king's favor were promoted to pretty lofty positions, and not only did they receive honor, they received good compensation. Now, not while they were working necessarily, because while they were working, the king claimed to be poor and he couldn't really pay them, so they had to get their money from other sources, like the church itself or people of the church. But what I'm saying is there were some men who pleased the king and were well compensated. It's kind of like the political system works today. So did these men have any influence on their work? I would say, yeah, there was influence. But I want you to look at instruction number two because of the issue that we're looking at. We're looking at the word ekklesia, and we just read an article where the man claims the word ekklesia was mistranslated when it was translated into church. Instruction number two. Wrong. Instruction number three. This is the one I want to read. Number three. The old ecclesiastical words to be kept as the word church, not to be translated congregation. Huh. Wait a minute. What if it should have been translated congregation? What if it should have been translated assembly? Does it make any difference? And the answer is absolutely yes, it does. And we're going to see, because when you translate the word ecclesia, every time it shows up, that is when it's talking about Christians, you translate it every time as church, you lose the meaning of what ecclesia is. That's what this article is about, the first one we read out of. He says it was mistranslated many times. We look at King James's instructions to his translators, and he tells them, you translate it this way. Why would the king tell them that? Well, here's why, and this is my 2 cents worth, but to me, ecclesia, we're going to see as I read you some more, means a whole lot more than church. And King James had a church that he wanted to protect. It's part of his kingdom. King James wanted to be at the top of that church, and he wanted everybody looking to him as the head guy in his church. He wanted to be head of it all. He was the God. He was the literal physical descendant of God on earth. And he wanted that order protected. Whereas ecclesia, when people understand ecclesia and the difference in, say, just simply church, if people understand the difference, they would say, oh, wait a minute, ecclesia is a little bit more than that. So it does matter. So to point number one, is there a mistranslation problem? I'd say yes. The question number one, is there? Yes, I'd say there is. Did King James want it to be so? I'd say yes. Did he have an agenda in that? I think so. Yeah, I think so. So then question number two was, does it matter? Does it matter? Well, we'll see. Let me read some more. Okay, in this same, the first article I started in, let me read more. And I'm reading. In our English Bible, the Greek word ekklesia is translated in most places, church. The word ekklesia is found in 115 places in the New Testament. It is translated in English 113 times, church. And the remaining times it is translated assembly. In classical Greek, the word ekklesia meant an assembly of citizens summoned by the crier, the legislative assembly. Ah! Does that make any difference? That's different from just a church meeting, isn't it? That's different from just gathering and singing, praise Jesus, hallelujah. This is a legislative assembly. This is a legislative body called out by the crier. In other words, the crier can be anybody. It can be Brian running up and down the street. Come to the town meeting. Come to the town hall. Come for a meeting. We've got something important going on. And that's exactly what ecclesia is. We've got our community has something to deal with. So let me read that again. In classical Greek, the word ecclesia meant an assembly of citizens summoned by the crier, the legislative assembly. The word, as used in the New Testament, is taken from the root of this word, which simply means to call out. In New Testament times, the word was exclusively used to represent a group of people assembled together for a particular cause of or purpose. It was never used exclusively to refer to a religious meeting or group. An examination of the Greek word ekklesia reveals that the word is properly translated into English as the assembly or congregation. And I'm going to stop reading there momentarily. If you just caught that last sentence, and if you think about it, King James instructed his translators to do the opposite of what would be right and truthful. Why would he specifically give one of his instructions saying, you translate this word this way? Why would he do that? And I have to say that I believe the word would properly be translated as assembly or congregation, and that these called out ones were called out for more than just worship or a Bible study. There's a lot more to it than that. And always translating it simply as church leaves us absolutely without understanding. Back to reading again. It is used to refer to a group of persons that are organized together for a common purpose and who meet together. Brown states the word was used as early as the 5th century B.C. Ecclesia, derived via ekkaleo, which was used for the summons to the army to assemble. From kaleo, to call. So in that way, it was a military term. It was summoning the army to assemble for action. All right, it is attested from, let me skip some of this, from about the 5th century BC. It denotes in the usage of antiquity the popular assembly of the competent full citizens of the polis city. Now that what that is your civil body politic. That's what it is. The competent citizens, that is full citizens. That means people who have a say. In other words, we might say what the forefathers said had a lawful right to vote. Those folks who have a stake, who are full citizens and competent, when they gathered. So they weren't, this wasn't just a gathering of people who believed in Jesus or believers or Christians or what we might call them necessarily. There's times when this word ecclesia is definitely talking about something other than just a group gathered for a religious meeting. And so he's gone back now into the historical use of the word, and he's saying it definitely was the civil body politic gathering. And I'll read again. It reached its greatest importance in the 5th century and met at regular intervals. In Athens, about 30 to 40 times a year. Elsewhere, less frequently, and also in cases of urgency as an extraordinary ecclesia. Sounds kind of like the legislative bodies, the various legislative bodies, government, yeah, gathering to deal with state affairs. Yeah, or Congress or the state legislation, you know, they don't meet every day, you know, every like 5 days a week, normal. No, they have times they go and meet and times they're not there in assembly. So let me read again. Its sphere of competence included decisions on suggested changes in the law. Huh. Well, that's more than just a church service, isn't it? You know, you think they, at First Baptist Church in town, tomorrow they're going to discuss possible changes in the law? They better not. They better not, is right. They're 501c3, they'll be in big trouble. Let me start again. Its sphere of competence included decisions on suggested changes in the law, which could only be affected by the Council of the 400. On appointments to official positions, there you go, that's still political stuff, civil body politic. And, at least in its heyday, on every important question of internal and external policy, including contracts, treaties, war and peace, and finance. To these was added, in special cases, such as treason, the task of sitting in judgment, which as a rule fell to regular courts. The ecclesia opened with prayers and sacrifices to the gods of the city. So, depending on what the religion was, the prevalent religion of the people, it was a religious, it was religious in nature, but it was a civil body politic, and it was there to discuss affairs of state. One of the definitions I've seen, and I haven't put my hand on it again, I don't know where I saw it, was an assembly of the called out ones to discuss affairs of state. And if you consider everything I've just been reading, that fits. That definition fits with what we've been reading. So these people were assembled possibly by the crier. And that would be extra, you know, extraordinary conditions probably. But sometimes on regular schedules. And here's my point in all this. Ecclesia, in its truest usage historically, was speaking of this legislative body. They discussed law. They rendered judgment. They dealt with appointing people into important positions. They were civil body politic. So when Paul and his contemporaries talk about elders ruling well and talk about sitting in judgment in the body and judging the body rightly, they used the word ecclesia in their writings. When they used the word ecclesia, they weren't just talking about a church gathering. You see what I'm saying? Does it make a difference? Absolutely, it makes a big difference. Words mean things. So, let me read again. It should be noted that the word ecclesia was used to denote the meeting together of a special assembly. Brown further defines the word as to its political characteristics. Let me see how much of this I want to read here now. Okay. Thus, ecclesia, centuries before the translation of the Old Testament and the time of the New Testament, in other words, before the New Testament time, was clearly characterized as a political phenomenon, repeated according to certain rules and within a certain framework. It was the assembly of full citizens, functionally rooted in the constitution of their government system. And I'm paraphrasing a little bit now because I'm trying to. An assembly in which fundamental political and judicial decisions were taken. How about that? An assembly in which fundamental political and judicial decisions were taken. Let's see. I don't want to just read. Let's see. I want to touch on a couple scriptures here. Go to the book of Acts. Acts chapter 19. And while you're turning there, I'm going to see if I want to read any more of this. I may just go to another article. I've got another article I want to read some from. But in Acts chapter 19, verse 23, it says, "And about that time there arose no small disturbance concerning the way. For a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines from Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen of similar trades and said, 'Men, you know that our prosperity depends upon this business.'" Now, let me stop right there momentarily. What's going on here? Number one, in verse 23, it says, there arose no small disturbance concerning the way. Of course, the way is Paul and his contemporaries and the other brethren, our people, in other words, our people. There's a disturbance going on. Well, this man's concerned because our living depends on these idols we make, and these guys are telling people to get rid of their idols. So he's concerned. He's calling a gathering together, right? If you go down to verse 32, it says, So then some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what cause they had come together. So now they had rounded up folks. They had rounded up folks from the town to talk about, what do we do about this disturbance these men are causing? It's having an impact on our livelihood. It's causing a lot of trouble. You know what that word right there, assembly, is in verse 32? Ecclesia. Here are these townspeople getting together. The crier has gone out. Hey, you guys, hey, everybody come. We've got a problem to deal with. Ecclesia. And properly translated, these people are assembling to deal with this political problem. So, you get down to verse 39. "But if you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly." Verse 41, "And after saying this, he dismissed the assembly." Guess what word that is, verse 41? Ecclesia. What about that? Translated properly. This was an assembly gathered to deal with, it was a civil body politic meeting to discuss affairs of their society, of their community. And it wasn't translated church there, was it? So, properly translated, back in Acts chapter 7. Starting in verse 37, it says, "This is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel, 'God shall raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren. This is the one who was in the congregation in the wilderness together with the angel who was speaking to him on Mount Sinai, and who was with our fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you.'" Now I'm backing up. 37 to 30. I read all the way into 39. No, I didn't. 37 and 38. But in the beginning of verse 38, it says, "This is the one who was in the congregation." That word congregation, is that what King James says, by the way? Church. It does say church. Well, there you go. Verse 38. chapter 7, verse 38. Congregation is the right word. Assembly would be a good word. Church? They weren't necessarily the church. So, again, it's the word ecclesia. The word ecclesia. So, I'm showing you that the word ecclesia doesn't always mean church. And so, a lot of the times we see the word church and we think of it in our contemporary thinking. We think it's a group of folks that meet in churches like we do. And when we think of elders and deacons, we think of the kind of elders and deacons we grew up with who, you know, counted the offering and maybe visited somebody in the hospital and maybe sat on a finance committee, et cetera, et cetera. We have no concept because we don't know what an ecclesia is or what the guys who wrote the New Testament scriptures were thinking when they wrote ecclesia. So we don't understand when it's talking about rulers, elders ruling, what it, literally in what churches around us or any churches we've ever been a part of, do elders rule? Do they rule at all? No, they probably won't even speak to a brother about sin. If they do, it's not going to be dealt with as far as dealing with it like the ecclesia would deal with it. So now, with a little more, hopefully a little more understanding, well, let me look at this other article. I may want to read some out of here. Let me read just a little bit out of this article. What is the ecclesia? The word church in the New Testament is translated from the Greek word ekklesia, which comes from two words, ek, meaning out, and kaleo, meaning to call. An ecclesia, or calling out, was not just an assembly. The words agora and panegyrus, as well as herte, koinon, theosis, and synago, can all mean an assembly. And we have used the word koinonia ourselves. It just means fellowship, right? So, in other words, these other words can be used to just talk about some folks gathering together. Back to the article. The word ecclesia was a political term, not a religious term. Jesus was the king, and the Bible used the term ecclesia for a good reason. In classical Greek, ecclesia meant an assembly of citizens summoned by the crier, the legislative assembly. So this article bears witness. It's a second witness to what we read from the other fellow. In Israel, back to reading, in Israel, the legislative assembly was originally composed of the elders of each family group, or we could say tribe. By the time of Christ, it had become a body of rulers exercising authority over the people of Judah, or Judea. It was a body of lawmakers who exercised authority and ran the offices of government through a vast bureaucratic system. Okay. Let me read again. Since the authority of the state in Israel was originally in the hands of the elders of each family, they did not, they did not usually gather together to overthrow the corruption of government since they were the government. The heads of every household were the princes of Israel, which was a government of the people, for the people and by the people, under the God of heaven, as long as they remained faithful to him. But once the voice of the people sought a king who appointed officers over them from the top down, the need for the ecclesia steadily grew. Let's see if I want to read any more of this. I think I'll just skip on past that. I could read much more out of there. Not a whole lot of difference in what we've already pointed out, really. He does come from a different angle. on some things, but the bottom line is, you remember we've talked about typology. And in the Old Covenant, we had the Levites. The Old Covenant, the people of Israel were the kingdom people. And the Levites were those who ministered spiritually, ministered to the spiritual needs of the people Israel. And it was the Levites who were everything from the singers and musicians to the judges and the teachers of the law, etc. And we've talked about in typology how they are the type, and in the New Covenant, the anti-type or the reality of it is you still have the kingdom people, and then you have a modern day ministers who minister to the spiritual needs of the people. And this is still a kingdom law order or society. It is kingdom. The kingdom is a reality. Remember, the word said there will be no end to his kingdom. And those who believe that his kingdom is reality make up that kingdom society, that society law order, complete with elders who are the rulers. They're the ones who teach the law, who render judgment, who sit in judgment, and who are the leaders to maintain the law order of kingdom society in the new covenant. See, the kingdom society still exists. So in New Testament scriptures, we see a conflict going on. Remember when the people delivered up Christ to Pilate, they said, "We have no king but Caesar." Remember that? Those people said, "We have no king but Caesar." Well, then the apostles in the new covenant were going around saying, "There's another king, not Caesar. It ain't Caesar." Remember? That's what they were saying. That's what was getting them in trouble. And so you had these two societies. It was a cultural war. It was a kingdom war. Two kingdoms. Kingdom of darkness versus kingdom of light. So then when you see some of these scriptures like we've seen in 1 Timothy 5, where it says, the elder who rules well, and again the word proestimai means to rule, to be set over. It's literally talking about elders of the ecclesia, the shoulders of the kingdom government, doing what the elders in Israel did. Ecclesia is just that antitype, the reality, the new covenant reality. So let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5. Verse 12 says, "But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another." Now it's interesting. He says they diligently labor among you. They have charge over you, and they give you instruction. You know what those words right there, charge over you, are? You know the word? Rule. That's right. Proestimai. Again, same word as 1 Timothy 5. Proestimai. To rule over, to be set over. So, again, they give you instruction. They labor over you. They are rulers. They are, in other words, he is saying, these are the elders in the ecclesia.
King James says, are over you.
Are over you? Okay. And that's the word, proestimai. Romans 12. Romans 12, verse 3. And I'm gonna be stopping here after this, I believe. We're just about out of time. Verse 3. "For through the grace given me, I say to every man among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. For just as we have many members in one body, and all the members do not have the same function, So we who are many are one body in Christ and individually members one of another. And since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let each exercise them accordingly. If prophecy, according to the proportion of his faith. If service, in his serving. Or he who teaches, in his teaching. And he who exhorts, in his exhortation. He who gives, with liberality. He who leads, with diligence. He who shows mercy, with cheerfulness. So the word, in at least in the New American Standard, in verse 8, when it says, he who leads, you know what the word is? Rule. Proistomai. So, there's a reason, and I'm going to stop there because I'm trying to keep from running over time the way that I seem to do habitually. So I'm going to put a mark right here. I've got more to show you regarding this. Let me mark my notes. But
King James says, he that ruleth.
He that ruleth. Okay. King James, there's a good translation. He that ruleth. So again, again, when we think of church with what we've grown up with, and when we think of deacons and elders, we do not think of ecclesia, and we do not think of ruling and judging. And judging the law and teaching and instructing the law. We do not think of a kingdom society law order. In fact, I just remembered a part of one of these. Here I go again now. I'm going to run over time. I may have to get to this next time. But what they were doing was they were peacefully revolting against the statist tyrannical government. They were pulling out their support and their citizenship, and they were becoming citizens of another kingdom. They were supporting it, and that placed them at odds with the tyrant because he wanted their money. Is there anything different today? Is there anything new under the sun? And that's why they were having their homes and lands taken. That's why they were being thrown in prison, thrown to the lions, etc., etc. It's not because they were preaching Jesus. They could have preached Jesus all day long, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as long as they did what the rulers told them and handed over the money. But they were peacefully not accepting the chains. They were peacefully saying, we have another king. They didn't go up, bear arms against the tyrant or any such thing. But they did peacefully revolt and withdraw their citizenship. So I think we're going to have to stop there. We'll get back to it. Questions and comments?
Yes.